You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. If you missed your favorite program, don't worry. You can listen to podcasts of our program at cjsf.ca.
I'll be the therapy that you need, baby, right here at home. Get lost in my body and pretend that nothing is wrong.
Quasi-cerebral talk and tunes. Broadcasting from unceded Coast Salish territories, this is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's your next hour of commentary and music.
But we just need one night to apply that good pressure.
This is part one of a two-part series.
Hi, I'm the wonton noodle soup that has been watered down and doesn't really taste like wonton noodle soup. Like, I'm pretty sure this is chicken bouillon powder, but it's, I don't know, it's just not that, it's not, just, it doesn't hit. My name is Leslie.
Hi, I'm like the stale like pineapple bun that you bought from the bakery, but you decided to eat the egg tart first and forgot about. I'm Gal, local tattooer and artist in SoCal, Vancouver.
Awesome. Yeah, that's our show today. We're very subtly Asian traits happening on the program.
No.
And you're tuned in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. CJSF broadcasts on unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam First Nations, and Typically Tuesdays is produced on unceded Catsey, Coquitlam, and Stolo First Nations. Of course, by unceded territories, we mean that these lands were never surrendered, relinquished, nor handed over to either of the states of what we know today to be Canada nor British Columbia. And we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers of this land. With particular regard to today's topic, we make our land acknowledgement while asking some questions. What are Chinese Canadians' relationships to these lands and to the state as racialized and Chinese settlers? How does Chinese settler identity and lived experience complicate the colonial holiday known as Canada Day? How does being Canadian inform how Chinese Canadians navigate solidarity and community with other racialized individuals and Indigenous peoples in Canada? Our conversation tries to explore these topics.
Gal is on the program here with me again today. If you might remember them. I interviewed them a few weeks ago at Good Stank Mart, and today we're going to do a program that I like to call Chinese Canadian Power Hour, in which we're going to talk about just things relating to being Chinese Canadian, kind of. Not that that never happens on the show, that happens every week on the show and sometimes extraly on the show because Jade is also Chinese Canadian, but you know, that's going to be the program today. How are you doing, Gal?
I'm doing good. I love the name of the program. It's a really sunny today. I went to print out my zine and I've been like cutting up the pages and stapling it. So that's most of my day so far. How about you?
I am okay. I am happy that it's not too hot today. It looks like it's actually really, really windy in Poco today. Which is exciting because I don't like hot weather, but I know it's supposed to get a lot hotter in the next few days. And this might be the last that you see of me, Gal. So
there's no wind where I'm at, but I put on sunscreen.
Oh, whoa. Did you put on sunscreen for the tattoos?
Yeah, but like all over my body, even when there's no tattoos on them. But yeah, like I tell all my clients to wear sunscreen. So, you know, I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't put sunscreen on myself.
That's good. I should be more mindful of sunscreen. I'm a bad client in that
it's
way.
Okay. I feel. Whether you have tattoos or not, everyone listening now has to put on sunscreen.
Yeah, yeah. Even if you're in your own home, just sitting there. Yeah.
Actually, I learned that like the sun can just like get you even in your home. Like obviously, yeah, because light travels, but I didn't know like you actually should be wearing sunscreen inside.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Oh, okay, cool. That's good to know. I learn something new every day. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. It's kind of like a little bit of the topics that we're going to be discussing today, yes. In which I've already learned too much. That's just how it is. Sometimes you learn about stuff that happens on Tumblr. Yeah, we're going to be talking about like kind of like being Chinese Canadian from some different perspectives. I myself am a second generation settler. Would you like to share a little bit about yourself as well, Gal?
For sure. I would be fourth generation on my dad's side. My family has both roots from China and Hong Kong. And also just being in Canada for several generations. I don't really know how much else I like really have the intro. I guess like I would say my paternal grandparents were very involved in our local Chinatown. And yeah, there's like some other stuff that like my family talks about, but I'd have to like fact check it a little better before I say anything. Stuff about Barkerville, but that's another topic for another time.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, so we're going to be talking about being Chinese Canadian. I hope you enjoy that.
We're going to start off with a song. This is Do You Want to Dance by Century Egg.
Do you want to dance?
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays. My name is Leslie.
Oh, and I'm Gal.
Yeah, Gal is a local artist and tattoo artist who's here with me today on the program because we're going to talk a little bit about like identity, cultural identity and stuff like that. The reason why we're doing this show is because on the day we're recording, it's July 1st. It's also known as Humiliation Day among a lot of people, particularly Chinese people and Chinese Canadians living in Canada. So I'm going to read a little bit by Hudson Lin, who wrote just like a very informative piece on the Chinese Exclusion Act to give you a more summarized version of what it is. Hudson writes, "For most Canadians, July 1st is considered the national birthday, but for many Chinese Canadians, July 1st is Humiliation Day, the anniversary of the passing of the Chinese Exclusion Act that tore apart hundreds of families. Passed in 1923, the Chinese Exclusion Act closed the border to any Chinese immigration. This meant that many fathers working in Canada were not allowed to bring over their wives or children. In many cases, these families kept apart by a racist Canadian law for decades. The act was only repealed in 1946. As we recognize Canada Day, let's not forget our country's racist history and its racist present. It's in every province and territory, every government body, every police department, every company and organization. It's systemic, but it shouldn't have to be." And that's why we are here today. Kind of to, we don't have to discuss that topic in particular, but, you know, being children of the diaspora and experiencing forms of anti-Chinese racism and xenophobia in our day-to-day life, you know, it shapes a person's view of the world and self and stuff like that. For me personally, like my relationship to the Chinese Exclusion Act is that like it did not affect my family. My parents came here in the early 90s. So my family was lucky to not have experienced it. But by the time that I had gotten into high school, it was still not something that was like really widely discussed. Like we didn't really learn that. When I was in grade 10, we might have gotten like a blurb, as it is with a lot of public high school education out here. And it is really only in the past couple of years that I've learned a little bit more about it, particularly, for example, like why July 1st is called Humiliation Day, because the act was passed on June 30th. So Chinese Canadians woke up on July 1st and were humiliated. You don't have to go too into it if it's like trauma, but like do you want to share a little bit about like your thoughts and stuff?
Yeah, my family actually was affected by the Chinese Exclusion Act. I'm not going to go too deep into it, but my family educated me on it, so I was very aware. I would say I didn't really learn about it in like high school social studies very much. We learned about the fur trade and that was it. When it came to the Chinese Exclusion Act, I remember this is when I was still very young, so my memory is a little fuzzy, so hopefully no one like is too harsh on fact checking me. I remember when the Canadian government was urged by protesters to compensate the descendants of those that had to pay the Chinese head tax. I believe the Canadian government was not willing to pay the equivalent of what it would be now for the amount. And so it was it's just a humiliation on top of more humiliation. Also, we shouldn't have to protest for reparations in any sort of way. So yeah. That's my two cents.
Yeah. It's definitely, I really resonate with what you said just now with like, it's humiliation on top of humiliation, right? Mm-hmm. Like first you did this to this community of people, and now like they have to like remind you of like, you know, hey, you still refuse to acknowledge this, and you still mm-hmm. refuse to like compensate us correctly or make up for it. I don't know, I personally find that like for me, like I'm not sure, I don't know, maybe it's like my conspiracy theory brain thinking, but like I feel like if it were compensated to the amount that it should technically be now with inflation and all that, I would still like have to ask, what more should the Canadian, like what more can the government do to make up for not only yeah, to make up for that, right? Because like, yes, resources are good, but also like I sometimes feel like, would the government think of it as like hush money?
You know? Oh, I have something good to say. Well, not good. Like, I have something good to contribute in this discourse. I would say, one, you can never pay off like a racist or oppressive act. And so, like, even if the government like was like, here's reparations with like, you know, inflation equivalent, right? That's not really the end of it. Though I could see certain people would be like, well, you've been paid off, now stop complaining. But I would say that, and these are stories that I've heard that are like passed like down from like mouth, like word of mouth type of passed down stories that my family has told me. A lot of people that were able to pay to have their relatives come over, one, there was a lot of work to save enough money. And thankfully, the community of like, current Chinese people who are here, some of them just grouped together and were like, okay, we're going to group our savings to bring your family member over. And like our family members are still not able to come over. So there have been lots of sacrifices, and families were only able to come here and like eventually like have more generations down the line because of the sacrifice of other Chinese people. And might I add, there's a lot of generations that will never know because some families were never able to come over, and families were permanently broken up. People had to start new lives, unfortunately, because it was lonely. For a lot of usually the men that came over to work and then bring their wives and kids over after. So, and I don't really want to like go off on too much of a tangent, but some men were not able to bring family over, not even for monetary means, but due to Chinatown riots and other things. Some of, you know, our brothers at the time back then disappeared. And you can only assume what happened, you know, but I think it was a sort of anti-Chinese violence that took them away. And so there's a lot of like, there's a, like a huge ripple effect that comes off from the Chinese Exclusion Act that, again, would affect today, because some people never had a chance to bring their family over, have a family, start a family, you know. And yeah, I'm just saying, like, I'm glad our community has resilience and has been able to prosper in some ways by still existing. So even if the government was like, here's the money to make up for everything, you can't undo all the damage that was done. It's literally like, this is all I can do for you. But
yeah,
who knows if the government's going to acknowledge it that way.
Yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from. And I definitely hear you. It's like when we look at the myriad of histories of like, you know, like nation states and colonial powers trying to for lack of a better word, like erase and like kind of like eradicate groups of people. Like that's mm-hmm. often where they first start, right? Is like separating the families in some way. You know, classic eugenics and
yep.
Is that the term? Yeah, maybe classic eugenics. But also, yeah, that's just unfortunately the truth of the matter is like, you know, that is where things start. I wanted to talk to you a little bit, I guess, kind of like not to hard pivot into a different topic, though, but kind of
no worries.
Kind of there. You know, I kind of building on what you're saying about how the Exclusion Act continues to see its legacy right now. I think another way that it does is like just the way that I think its legacy still permeates is in like some things that are sometimes like not very democratic that happen that tend to for whatever reason like affect Chinese communities in particular. For example, like the gentrification of Chinatown and like yes. how residents there get displaced. You know, we mm-hmm. listeners to the show may recall my conversation with Russell Chung from Chinatown Today, but Chinatown Today also you know, wrote a very thoughtful post on social media today discussing the effects of exclusion from the Chinese Exclusion Act. And in that they write, even after the Chinese Exclusion Act was repealed, race-based restrictions on Chinese immigration continued until 1967. And today we still see attempts to erase our communities like Chinatown through planned violence of gentrification and displacement. Would you like to share some thoughts on that?
Super well worded. Couldn't have said it better myself. I don't know if I'm going like it's relevant, but I always just worry that I go off on tangents because how I drone on and on. But I'd like to like pose a question to anyone listening. And I have like put this on social media myself, like on the topic of gentrification and state violence, etc. Okay, in Vancouver, it is not a it's not a new topic that we talk about developments. How everyone in Vancouver is tired of like luxury developments, like let's say Vancouver House, which is like a huge, like fancy architectural building. Who at night I don't see a lot of the lights on. So I'm like, who can afford this? Anyways, so nobody likes luxury developments right now in Vancouver. It's really hard to afford groceries. That is also a common discussion that's happening. And if people, also rent is going up a lot, exponentially. So if people are against like luxury condos, like people can't afford rent, people can't afford groceries, right? Like in Vancouver, Metro Vancouver, just in general, like I don't really see how this is like somehow like I don't see how this is the go-to for Chinatown in terms of gentrification. I feel like there's just some cognitive dissonance here or some intentional turning the other cheek type of thought process, because we have like we already have an active community in Chinatown. We have like a lot of low-income seniors on fixed income living in Chinatown. And we have a lot of businesses that are accessible for Chinatown seniors, downtown East Side, also accessible for us. A meal in Chinatown is way more affordable for me than a meal downtown. Obvious. No one can contest this. but for some reason, and I don't know if I'm broaching this topic too early in the episode, but, you know, 105 Kiefer, there's no reason why we should be supporting this development of luxury condos. What is it? What is it going to do for Chinatown? Because we already have it in, what has it done for Vancouver? You know what I mean? Like, Vancouver House is like so empty. And let's say every unit is bought by someone for this luxury condo at 105 Kiefer. What does that do? Right? Like, what does that do for the local community? There's already diminishing grocery stores in Chinatown. So I guess I'm going on so many questions. I'm like, what do you expect seniors living in Chinatown to do when their grocery stores are disappearing if they want to buy groceries? And there's only like expensive boutique grocery stores. Like, they're definitely not able to afford it because groceries are expensive for the regular Vancouver, right? And they're on fixed income. And what are you going to tell the senior to do? Like, oh, like go bus 30 minutes over to Victoria Drive, buy all the groceries you need for the week or like the month and carry it back by hand on the bus. Like, I don't even like carrying groceries on transit myself, and I'm an able-bodied young person. You know what I mean? I'm going off on like, I'm just going off, and I'm speaking very colloquially and not like necessary so academic-wise. So I know like that can be a little jarring for some people, but I just think it's a very simple concept that everyone should get. I don't think necessarily tourism is the key to revitalize Chinatown. And I'm not saying I'm against tourism, but I don't see how tourism goes hand in hand with forgetting about our most vulnerable and marginalized groups. You know what I mean? If your revitalization of Chinatown does not include harm reduction, and it actually promotes harm to the local community, then that's not revitalizing Chinatown. And that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from there. And I agree in many ways. Two of the things that stood out to me was what you were saying was the question about groceries, right? Like, how are Chinatown seniors able to, like, how are they going to be able to afford groceries? Well, the thing is also, like, transit it can be quite difficult for people to access public yes. transportation as well. Not to reveal too much about myself, in my workplace, most of our clients are low-income newcomers, and we regularly have, like, a cache of bus tickets that our organization purchases for the specific use of our clients. And we go through them super quickly because for a lot of people, they can't really afford to get like a 3-zone monthly bus pass every single month, right? Even 1-zone when it's how much is it right now? Maybe something close to $100. I haven't checked since today they changed the transit fares, but a lot of people who are on very fixed income, you know, like if they're getting only a couple $100 a month on their pension, that is expensive for them. The other thing that I really resonated with you on is like this question of like, you know, why is it okay for luxury condos to be developed in Chinatown when residents don't like them getting developed anywhere else? And the thing that I suddenly thought of was like, maybe it is an issue with how Chinatown has been framed for a while, I would say probably for the past like 15 or so years as a tourist destination. I think I remember being in middle school it must have been around the time we had the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, so about 2010. And I was delighted to see like the